Yeah.
Now, ne, I got a note there. Can you go ahead now?
These two terms that somebody brought up some time ago, sadism and masochism. Now, conceptions there are that this is where hostility and sexuality get fused. And sadism is aggression directed toward the object with the implications of hurting the object or making the object suffer. But it is an object from whom one expects certain kinds of libidinal gratification. So that in our sense here again, you can see that if we talk about barrier and goal, that if you put barrier and goal together, then of course, as frequently happens as a matter of fact, because this is one of the ways that we could explain the difficulty the child has about biting the breast, that the goal and the barrier are one and the same, so to speak. So here too, where the object itself is valued for libidinal or dependency, sufferance gratifications, and where there is also hostility directed against it, then, obviously, the aim of the primitive aim of aggression, which if we postulate it as being total destruction of the object, has to be inhibited here to only make the object suffer and not to kill it. Because if one totally destroyed the object that one needed, then obviously, you see, this would be a kind of situation which would be most unrewarded. So that in this sense, I would also point out the difference between the satisfaction of the libidinal or the sufferance gratifications and the satisfaction of the hostility tensions. That it's possible to try to completely satisfy dependency and love needs. This is very difficult on the person who is chosen as the vehicle around whom the satisfaction is obtained, but at least it's possible and it doesn't damage the individual. It might make them most uncomfortable and put them into avoidance flight. But if you completely satisfy a tremendous amount of hostility, which has still its primitive goal of destruction, well, then, of course, you destroy the object which has high value for you on the positive side. And so, therefore, in this sense, barrier and goal can get together. Well, sadism is the term which is used to point specifically to the wish to hurt the object which one also wants to be loved by. And masochism, therefore, means the turning of this same kind of thing against the self, that is to say, of being hurt in the process of getting libidinal gratification. And if we can somehow think about these terms as we go along, then perhaps we may be a little clearer, and whether or not they satisfy theoretical aspirations is not so important as that this is the current coin of theory in the realm of psychodynamics, and therefore one has to proceed on this basis. Well, now, if we think then for a time about the vicissitudes of aggression, then obviously we have to ask ourselves what provides for the, first of all, the appearance, the intensity and duration of aggression, and how is aggression elaborated and handled by the individual in seeking to discharge the tension associated with aggression, because again, it has to function as a need drive, evoking tension, and the tension seeks and presses for satisfaction. The satisfaction may be either directly achieved or achieved via a bypass, which can be through the operation of a certain number of habits, which the individual learns, consciously or unconsciously, to use to get this gratification. So then, if we would say, we do not know, as we do not know about very many, about any of the other instincts, very much about the innate intensity of these drives. That is to say, it would be nice if somehow we had some hormonal index of the appetency for sexuality and the appetency for aggression, but we do not have these indices. And yet we know that certainly impressionistically that individuals vary a good deal in terms of their at least motility, which may be one expression of aggression, and that you can see this difference very early in life. So we are again in the position of simply pointing to the biological determination of variations in the aggressive character and then going on to develop it psychologically. Now, aggression can occur, hostility, let us say, now to be a little more specific in our sense, can occur whenever the individual is deprived in terms of getting to some goal. Now, this is axiomatic, and we are again not sure, and certainly this is borne out more and more if one studies, for example, the early childhood of schizophrenics, of really disorganized individuals, that we are not sure that merely the interpersonal transactions in terms of deprivation and hostility reactions are the only thing that determine, let us say, the adult handling an issue of hostility. Because so frequently we see the same kind of child-mother interpersonal relationship producing quite different adult personalities. So we have to be, again, wary about how much we always point to deprivation by the mother, counter-hostility by the child, as being pretty much a cut-and-dried affair, which, given a depriving mother, you get a hostile a child whose destiny is going to be decided by how much anxiety he gets about this hostility. In general, certainly we can always make it appear as if this is true, because our techniques for evaluating the early childhood years, as you know, are not too adequate. But now, if we postulate that a child begins to have difficulty in getting the goals reached, and if the mother, who is the goal also, becomes at the same time a barrier toward the kind of satisfaction the child wants, then, of course, deprivation will occasion hostility. Now, the hostility, therefore, will come to be a need which has to be discharged. And this may get discharged in various ways, depending upon the individual's personal destiny. Very early in life, for example, when the child first develops teeth, there is considerable feeling, and this is backed up by considerable clinical actual evidence, that this is the first real struggle about the control of hostility. Because if the child has been expressing hostility a good deal beforehand, before, that is to say, his teeth arrive, then the problem of getting and biting the breast, hurting the breast, having the breast move away, trying to hold the breast which withdraws by increased biting, gets to be a difficult kind of thing in terms of learning to handle the inhibition about fighting. And if we again assess some of the fantasy that children later display, then we know that in this realm of what we call the zoophobias, or maybe generally the phobias in a more general way, that the young children from 2 to 3 in the nursery school have much more fear of animals who eat or chew or attack you by the teeth. So that the implications that we would like to see here is that the child gets somehow makes a projection at this stage of the game to the dangers of biting, the hostility about biting, and the counter-hostility which is expected in kind, that if he bites and wants to damage the mother this way, then there is counter-damage and counter-biting to be expected from the world outside, which is symbolized by him in terms of a biting, chewing animal. Later on, the kinds of animals that children fear, that's between the ages of 3 and 5, are largely overpowering animals. I mean, the difference here in Fairyland is between Red Riding Hood and Jack the Giant Killer, so to speak. And so that we have to at least put some credence upon the fantasy life of the child, and in terms of the projections that go on at that age, because we see so much evidence of so-called oral hostility in adult fantasy and in myths, and everybody knows that fairy tales are not written for children, but for adults. And so that, again, the reappearance of this kind of fantastic hostility has its genesis largely in this period of time. Now, the applications here, of course, that have been made have been to, for example, associate witchcraft with these oral sadistic fantasies. The fantasies about witches who put bad things into people, or who suck bad things out of people, all of this would, well, at least by analogy, seem to be related to fantasies about oral aggression. So similarly, the idea of the cannibalistic mother generally may very well have been originated around the hostility reactions evoked in this period of time. Now, of course, the important thing for our point of view would be somehow to demonstrate the cultural variability in this time of taking things in with hostility, and relate it somehow to the motherhood deprivation in a general sense. That is to say, the supposition ought to be that where deprivation was low in terms of food giving to the child, that the kind of oral hostility fantasies ought to be diminished in intensity, and we ought not to get very much, for example, paranoid psychotic ideation about being poisoned, which we feel is somehow a regressive fantasy about eating something with hostility, and if you take in something with hostility, then you have something bad inside you, and therefore the interpretation is that this could kill you and therefore is poison. Now, as I say, we in our contemporary adults, we see a good deal of this in the paranoid schizophrenic this designation, and the thesis that since we know that most paranoid schizophrenics have a great deal of trouble with their hostility needs, it is not too difficult, at least, to assume that the high hostility which the schizophrenic person got engendered in him very early around the breast, and which was maintained by a hostility-depriving mother, a hostility-evoking depriving mother, somehow set the stage for the intensity of these oral fantasies. But at least I put this out to you as one of the way stations on the way to the consideration of the elaboration of aggression. Now, as one moves along in the child's development, then of course you find that there is increasing hostility toward people who share mother's love. That is to say, and this again will be culturally and personally determined by how much the mother actually totally satisfies the child, and how much she allows the child to progressively leave her and become more and more independent. Now, this rivalry situation, as Dr. Linton pointed out last time, certainly changes a great deal in terms of whether one is in a kinship family or whether one is in a conjugal type family. This brings up, I think, an interesting point, because we know from an actual experiment, which has been done many times in the orphanage situation, that if we allow our own children in this culture to grow up without very much personal contact, with only the very casual kind of contact that an institution merits, and I would say an institution is probably a kinship family without love, then we know that these children are by and large extraordinarily aggressive children who have no anxiety about being aggressive, and who become what we call in our jargon, psychiatrically, the psychopathic personalities. Now, the other insistence there, however, is that if there is not so much intensity and intimacy between mother and child, but a little more extensity, then at the same time the child is allowed more expression for his hostility, then we ought to find a situation where we do not have psychopathic children, but where we have children who, while they do not form tremendously intense love relationships, at the same time are not so anxious about their hostility, can express it in various ways that are acceptable, and who do not become, let us say, disorganized around the problem of hostility. Now, this is at least one variable that is introduced here, simply in terms of the size of the families. Now, if we think about the Oedipal situation, which Dr. Linton discussed the last time, as being a situation where there is a good deal of rivalry, first of all, between father and mother, and there's a good deal of rivalry between younger siblings and older siblings, all in the growing development of the child, where he has to learn to share the source of his gratification with other people. And these other people become then the barriers to complete, immediate, total gratification. And so to the extent to which these other barriers have no other counterclaims upon the individual, there can be increasingly intense hostility directed toward these interfering people with mother. To the extent to which there are counterclaims, the hostility has to be disguised in some way, its aim retracted, its goal distorted, so that conflicting needs can be resolved. And so, similarly then, we can put all of the people in the child's familial relationships, whether kinship or conjugal, in terms of what kind of barrier are they to mother, and what are the counterclaims that these barriers impose upon the child in terms of the total expression of hostility. Now, if father, for example, has never been anyone who has gratified the child in any way, therefore does not evoke very much counterclaim on the child in terms of softening hostility, then, of course, the hostility toward father can be very pristine and quite open. And so we know that the Oedipal situation is most intense when this kind of relationship happens, that the father has not been a gratifying object to the child, on the contrary, has been a punitive object, and the mother has been highly gratifying and the sole source of gratification, as a matter of fact. Then the father can be much more a real hostile barrier, a real barrier toward whom full hostility can be directed in fantasy. Because, of course, the other thing about hostility expression at various age levels is the fear of the retaliation, that is to say, the fear of counter-hostility. And this becomes one of the great counterclaims in terms of the hostility against the barrier. Now, we trade very heavily in dealing with hostility upon the kind of adaptive mechanism called projection. Because the tendency is in all of us, we can see it operating quite much in ourselves, to attribute to the other person the same kinds of feelings about ourselves that we have about ourselves. In other words, to attribute to him our internalized experience. And our internalized experience is that if we're very hostile people, that we are people who are hated because we have such hostility, and therefore these other people will hate us because they know we're hostile. I mean, this is now the phenomenology, let us say, of the technique of projection. Now, if this occurs, you see, it does occur at any age, and maybe the phenomenal world of the child certainly is much different than ours, and maybe this is a much more real kind of projection for the child than it is for us. That is to say, that we are not too aware of making this projection, and we're not too much aware of some kind of let us say, link between us and the other person, but maybe the child's world has more of this kind of thing in it, more animistic endowment is what I would like to say here, and that therefore the concept of projection for the child means much more fear from the person toward whom counter-hostility is projected than for us. Now, certainly we know children behave as if this is true, and there again we see the psychodynamic reason for such things as nightmares and such things as phobias. Because in the dream, and this was the French psychiatrists of the 19th century were pointed this out, incidentally Freud came to the same independent conclusion about projection first in the dream by observing that in a dream we attribute to other people thoughts and our own thoughts and feelings and behaved as if the other person were somebody who was different than us and yet who still had our thoughts and feelings. And the French psychiatrists, as I say, Marc Fario and Mario and a few of these other people in the 19th century, about 1860, called this the doubling of the personality in the dream, and we're already pointing this out. Well, in any event, the explanation, therefore, of the nightmare, because child psychiatrists, as those of you who are child psychiatrists here know, think of the nightmare as being evidence of the projection of the child's hostility, fear about his own hostility, into the expectance of counter-hostility from outside. Now, I want to pause here and make what I think is an important point. I don't know how naive it is, but at least to me it seems important. That introduces this concept. You see, the analyst would call this, all right, now this is the creation of the superego. This is the internalization of the external sources of strength and of power and of discipline and of succor in forms of the parents. And therefore, the parents return in the dream as the evil, punishing, powerful parents, either in their own guise or in some different human guise or in the guise of an animal. And that therefore, these archaic dream figures are really pictures of the infantile superego. Well, now, I only want to point out one thing, which I think is much different between our culture, for example, and pre-literate cultures. And that is that in this culture, we tend habitually to think only of social, interpersonal relationships in which destiny occurs. In the pre-literate society, there is a supernatural superego, that is to say, which even the adults themselves act as if really existed. So that when the child, let us say, the difference between a nightmare of a child in the Manu society as against the nightmare of a child in our society could be very great, even though on the surface they were both using, let us say, a very threatening animal or a giant to attack them. In the one case, in our culture, the child has only now his real experience with people, and therefore this must be somehow an emotionally intense and elaborate kind of symbolization of a parent. Whereas in the Manu culture, if this happened, this might really be a representation of a real existence, that is, insofar as it's psychologically real. And in most of our considerations about this kind of thing, we do not make a space in the person for the supernatural superego, which I think we ought to put there. I was particularly struck by this in my analysis of some of the psychotic delusions of schizophrenics in this South American culture that I examined. They behave toward people, even in their paranoid delusional state, as if people did not really have much power to threaten them. But it was the spirits who really had the power and of whom they were afraid. So that you got the paradoxical situation of a schizophrene who trafficked freely with you, but who was displacing, so to speak, in my terminology, all of his fear upon the powerful figures who were around in the form of spirits. And so it seems to me that we have to allow somehow in our conceptual system for the difference. I mean, persons to us are important. This is our own tendency towards self-awareness in this culture, that we have now withdrawn out of our projections from the heavens, we hope, and taken the will of God out of the heavens where it can be accepted irrationally as the will of God and put it into the unconscious, where it can also be irrational, but can only be reached with the aid of a psychoanalyst. This, obviously, is another shamanistic maneuver to control the irrational will of the world. But, nevertheless, the situation is certainly in this sense, and the result has been that we have personalized the world a good deal, and even our very psychology of interpersonal relations is culture-bound, because it implies that things other than people are not very important. Well, but So then, going back to the nightmare then, in our culture, we take to mean evidence of the fact that the child is not only afraid, which would be the obvious conclusion, but one cannot be too obvious in psychiatry, you understand. So we have to go behind this and say he is not just afraid, but he is afraid of counter-hostility from without, which is fear of his own hostility, that is to say his fantasy of hostility, which he is now behaving by projection as if he were this hostile, he would retaliate, there would be retaliation, and it's the other person, he's attributing to the other person his conception of the other person's power to retaliate towards him. Now, obviously, no father will kill his child, that is to say, in his right mind. So the ideas that children have about the pursuing lion, bear, tiger, the fear of horses, the phobias are being another situation here, because the child phobia may mean many things. The first child who was analyzed, little Hans, by Freud, had an extraordinary fear of horses, as you remember, and this turned out on analysis to be a symbolization of the father. And the maneuver there was that horses are the things which will attack you and bite you and overpower you, and if you avoid horses, then you can avoid this kind of cue from the outside, and therefore you avoid the area of danger. Now, it's very interesting that little Hans, you know, grew up to be a man, like all little Hanses usually do, barring destiny and a few other difficulties, and he completely could never remember having visited Freud, although he had done so weekly over a long period of time. So that again, if the idea is unrepression and a restoring of something to consciousness, then one can wonder why Freud and the whole business had to be repressed again. But this would, of course, you understand I'm really joking here. One has to express a little hostility this way by the joking relationship. Phobias, however, now this incidentally is another interesting thing. That is to say that if we analyze the cultural determinations of phobia, then I think we would be inclined to attribute to many preliterate societies a great deal of phobic behavior. That is to say, they seem to be highly afraid of what we think are fantasy situations. And yet again, the same kind of consideration holds, that for them, this is not fantasy, this is reality. And it's our conception that it's fantasy. And so again, we would not be too quick to talk about a phobic-ridden preliterate society merely because everybody in the culture was afraid of something which seemed to us to be a fantastic kind of fear. And incidentally, in terms, I may say here again, of analytic thinking and of psychodynamic thinking generally, you also have to be aware, as I think I stressed once before, that there is a great change in all psychopathologic psychodynamics by the admission of this concept of hostility. You see, this is a latecomer, and most all of the psychodynamics for most all of the nosologic classification of psychiatry had been evolved by 1920 using only libidinal ideas, libidinal gratification as the cause for the symptom. That is, the individual was out after gratification, the gratification was frustrated or deprived, the symptom was an effort at compromise solution. And our phobias were explained this way, and as a matter of fact, the phobia was given a position of fixation at the Oedipal period, and the phobias were thought to be only matters of sexual excitation, and that therefore what everybody was afraid of when he could not go in the subway or out on the street was Stress and Angst, or fear of the streets, fear of temptation, fear of being out where some of his forbidden libidinal gratifications might be evoked by the cues which came from the phobic source. Now, this was true for, as I say, for almost all of the nosological classifications. Now we know that the phobic situation is as likely to be underwritten by fear of being excited with hostility as it is fear of being excited by sexuality. And that therefore the situation is avoided because the individual associates the phobic situation with cues which would evoke in him cues of tremendous hostility, which he does not want to express because he fears a loss of control involved in this. And so the phobic situation is maintained not on a sexual basis, but on a hostility basis. That is to say, as the top presenting symptom. Now, obviously, if you want to know why is the hostility there, then you will always be back again to barriers in the way of gratifications. But similarly, the analysis of acute anxiety states, whenever a woman came in the clinic by 1915, let us say, with an acute anxiety state, immediately everybody went to work upon the sexual behavior. Now we know that high hostility, which is about to burst forth and can no longer be restrained, is much more frequently a cause of acute anxiety, even in women. So that the situation from the aggressive point of view, you see, has changed a good deal in this respect. Well, then we're then pursuing, let us say, the development of hostility. Now, I've been over here in these psychological variations. Now, if you could try to say, what shall we think in terms of the simple dynamics of whether hostility remains as a direct, aggressive kind of drive, or whether it gets bypassed and handled in various ways? What determines this? Well, we already have one answer experimentally in psychopathology again. That is to say, we have these children who have been deprived, who haven't been given any interpersonal succoring source with which to identify, and therefore no reason to inhibit hostility in terms of their reactions to deprivation, and so who have remained openly hostile and become, as they grow up, the antisocial, deviant, criminal personalities. That is, the people who take no restraint, who are impulsively and angrily and with hostility moving against the world. Now, this is one extreme. Now, as the individual is made more anxious about his hostility, then we have to look for anxiety as being the inhibitor which changes the aim and character of the hostility reaction. Well, now, how does anxiety get in to be an inhibitor? Well, obviously, it must have something to do with how much conflict about the free expression of hostility the object toward which the hostility is directed evokes in the person who is expressing the hostility. And the great inhibitor of hostility is, of course, its conflict with the possibilities of gratification, that is to say, with love. And the more love gratification is given to an individual in the broad sense, then, of course, the less hostility he will have because deprivation is low, and the easier it will be for him to give up this hostility if the expression of it threatens in any way the succurant's gratification relationship. Now, as the individual, however, gets, let us say, less, more and more deprived by the love object, at the same time is kept anxious about loss of this love, then to this extent he gets into difficulty about inhibition. And the inhibition then about aggression begins to go toward the, as we say in our jargon again, the obsessive compulsive position. That is to say, he doesn't know whether to hate or not to hate, and hence has a great deal of difficulty then really keeping hostility out of the picture. And we might call this, so to speak, about the 50-50 position so far as the open aggression, anxiety, deflection of aggression, trying to repress it, which is one of the ways one can handle it. Stop thinking that I have aggression. And this, of course, as you understand, is not a healthy way, and indeed, if it's ever really achieved. Or one can do a reaction formation, that is to say, begin to be sympathetic with other people and to be very concerned about aggression directed towards others in this sense. Or it can be displaced upon some person where the conflict about counterclaim is relatively lacking. That is to say, it can be displaced upon animals or upon some other people, or with the help of a cultural stereotype upon a group and become prejudiced, which is another possibility. That is to say, prejudice doesn't exist except as hostility fuses with an already existing cultural designation of a prejudicial pattern. Otherwise, we just call it hostility. So that there are these variations on the theme. Well, now, we usually say that most of us, apart from our psychopathological possibilities, which are, after all, not too great in this group, I mean only about 10% of us, for example, are definitely psychopathological, and I'll take one of those positions so that makes it still freer. Most of us develop what is called a character handling of our hostility. That is to say, the hostility gets diffused into the character as a set of habits which ostensibly are in the pursuit of other gratifications, but which also have a hostility rider on them, so to speak, so that the hostility uses the habits which are developed about something quite different in order to discharge itself. For example, one of the neatest illustrations of this in contemporary culture is driving. That everybody learns to drive, not for reasons of discharging hostility alone, but in order to get about and to have some method of transportation. But after having learned those habits, then of course they very nicely fit into the character discharge of hostility, because first of all, driving is a fairly anonymous kind of task. You can discharge a great deal of hostility and still be alone. Nobody really sees you. You go too fast for observance. And it's always safe because you could usually outdistance the other guy if he wants to fight, or something, there's too much traffic, and so on. So we couldn't have invented a better kind of hostility maneuver kind of thing than driving. The difficulty is that it doesn't act as catharsis, you see, because what one does is to transfer to the traffic the various individual cues which evoke your hostility in your original interpersonal learning, and therefore you're always getting stimulated by these cues and reacting, so to speak, all the time. The result is you actually keep yourself more hostile, openly, patently, physiologically too, than you would if you didn't drive. That is to say, some of us who have had very overpowering, rather hostile, difficult fathers are particularly evoked into hostility by trucks. So that any truck which comes aggressively not paying any attention to the situation, one immediately wants to drive into or something. Other people who have sibling rivalry hate to be passed up by somebody else, and so they speed around and cut in on the other fellow and so on, and there's a great need. Others show their needs, of course, in the way they buy cars. I mean, the Studebaker people, I'm sure, have a great deal of a specific phallic need, shall we say. So there are possibilities for this, but I remember a remark of Homburger Erickson's once when he was here some time ago, about 10 years ago, who was walking out in the street with one of the psychiatrists at the Institute, and a young man came by in a great big convertible Cadillac with two very nice blondes on the front seat. And Erickson, with the true perspicacity of a psychoanalyst, said, "Look at the impotent son of a bitch." Well, so this, you see, this is reaction formation. Well, so, but the diffusion of aggression in terms of the character is the way that most of us handle our hostility, and so therefore, it's perfectly proper and possible, I think, to speak about oral aggression, for example, where the individual uses his speech as a real way of expressing hostility. And hostility, of course, gets bypassed into all sorts of scientific activities. I suppose as much scientific truth has been discovered under the aegis of hostility as of the real, as of curiosity, that is to say, to show somebody else that they're wrong. And so that it has... Here we'd be hard put to it to know whether we should call it constructive anger or destructive anger. And so again, perhaps we don't need to linger about this. Well, now I want to move on to a consideration here of something I think that I mentioned just briefly in passing once before, which I think has a good deal of opportunity for cross-cultural research, and that is the whole question of psychosomatic disease. Because again, most recently, in the last 10 or 15 years, we have come to feel that it is aggression, hostility, that is to say, which is held within the self, which produces a good deal of tension psychologically, which is then has its concomitant physiological tension, and which therefore results in a good deal of psychosomatic disease. For example, the most obvious demonstration of this is in the kind of psychosomatic disease that's called essential hypertension. Now, in essential hypertension, this usually occurs in young individuals. They have a very labile blood pressure, which shoots up to 160 or so in times when they are emotionally excited, which while they're sleeping falls to the normal, and if they're under sodium amytal also falls to the normal. And there's great variability for about 10 or 15 years until they get to be about 40. And then if nothing has happened to them in terms of treatment, or if they don't really come to some terms with this diffuse character hostility, then they may develop then irreversible changes due to the constant hypertension, and actually then develop a real hypertensive kidney disease as a sequelae to this initiating psychogenic hypertension. Now, the hypothesis there is that these individuals, and by analysis one frequently finds that this is so, they keep themselves under a great state of chronic hostility. This is done by a rather obsessive thinking process. That is to say that they never quite can discharge their hostility, which is evoked in certain interpersonal situations they pass through the day. So the memory trace of these interpersonal situations is gone over privately, as if somehow by going over again one could discharge this hostility. The result is that not only the day's actual experience keeps them in a state of anger and hypertension, but the fantasy activity after the day's experience which engendered this is over also then perpetuates it in the evening and maybe in the dream even. So that you have the situation here of a very of a process where the individual, as I like to say, behaves as if he is just about to strike you. And you frequently see these people, as a matter of fact, going along the street. They look angry. They are simply the chronically angry people who, if you ask them about whether they're angry or not, usually do not know that they are, because by the very definition of a character neurosis, so to speak, or character trait, we become so accustomed to being what we are that we do not interpret this as any sort of abnormality. That is to say, it's the same kind of task we always have with people who are asked to relax. There are lots of people who are sent to the psychiatrist with the idea this man is tense, he must relax because there are very good reasons for this. And then the first thing you find out is that the individual has no idea that he's tense. And yet he may be sitting there, so to speak, with his nails dug into his palms, but the first thing you have to show him is that he is really tense, because he defends himself against knowing this. I mean, this is part, again, of the so-called unconscious aspect of this. That is to say, the hostility, in order to be acceptable, has to remain largely unknown, unverbalized. But it's there, and it causes this physiological concomitancy, and we have then this kind of situation. Now, the same thing, of course, well, this means, therefore, that if we were then pursuing cultures in which there was plenty of hostility engendered, and yet the hostility was dammed up, so to speak, and there were no other opportunities for the expression of hostility, such as sorcery, for example, then we ought to expect a high incidence of hypertension in such societies. That is to say that this is, again, tracing the fate and destiny of aggression, of hostility. If it's dammed up, and if it's bypassed somehow, again, in some socially approved way, then one ought to be able to discharge it and not remain chronically hostile. But if it escapes, so to speak, into the body, then it remains there as a force which keeps the body constantly prepared for what should be the real sequelae of being angry, namely fight. And hence, you're constantly bombarding not only the blood vessels themselves, but according to the newer conceptions of the stress adaptation reaction, the neurohumoral system, everything is being kept at a high level of function, and therefore there is a constant bombardment of the body with emergency biochemical measures. And hence, therefore, the problem of psychosomatic treatment via psychotherapy comes into this picture. Now, again, the same things are true with less emphasis upon such things as coronary heart disease, where one always has to have a damaged coronary system in the beginning, but that sudden episodes of anger, which do two things. First of all, they increase the work of the heart, and so encroach upon the coronary reserve this way, which is already diminished. And then there may be some real constriction of the coronary vessels because of the emotional reflection. In this setting, then, one has a situation where there is a heavy burden put upon the coronary blood supply. The old boy, you know, who's always quoted in this respect, was Sir John Hunter, who said that, "I am at the mercy of any scoundrel who chooses to make me angry." And the scoundrel who fulfilled the promise was one of the board of governors of St. George's Hospital, who told him he could not get this medical student in because he didn't have qualifications. And so it only goes to show you, don't ever try to get anybody in the medical school. You might have a coronary. in this sense. And then, of course, all the other difficulties. The colonopathies, the asthmas, and so on, all are now thought to be largely the result of resentment factors in which anxiety and hostility are mixed, but that's where resentment is an important factor. Now, I may, however, take a little time here to point out